WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And that's Madonna's 1989 hit, Express Yourself, playing us in for part three of our six-part World Pride Month series we're calling Prejudice and Pride, Decade by Decade Since Stonewall. All this week, we're having great guests for each decade since Stonewall in 1969, decade by decade, and taking lots of your oral history calls. We'll open the phones in a minute. Now let's talk about prejudice and LGBT pride in the 1980s, a period marked by profound tragedy due to the onset of HIV/AIDS and even greater public demonstrations to demand equality than in the 60s and 70s. Now, when AIDS was still a mystery, very late 70s, very early 80s, some doctors called it gay wasting syndrome for all the gay males who were literally becoming so skinny and then dying. While the first of what became known as HIV/AIDS eventually got that name, began to appear around 1981, it wasn't until 1983 that government officials began to talk about the epidemic. Here is Margaret Heckler, then Secretary of Health and Human Services, on August 17th, 1983.
I visited Peter Justice, who is a patient with AIDS. I have visited patients at NIH, the National Institutes of Health. I've sat with them and shaken hands with them, as I have with Peter today. And as you can see, I've taken no precautions because the very best scientific evidence has clearly demonstrated that one cannot contract AIDS through shaking hands, through dining in a restaurant with someone who has AIDS, through meeting them in stores or in workplaces or in casual conduct anywhere.
The Secretary of HHS, Margaret Heckler, in 1983. By 85, the Centers for Disease Control reported that more people were diagnosed with AIDS in that year, 1985, than in all earlier years combined. Here's a report from that year by San Francisco General Hospital.
AIDS is a new disease. It is usually transmitted sexually. It probably developed in Africa in the mid-1970s, then found its way to New York, to Los Angeles, to San Francisco. Today, there are more than 10,000 cases of AIDS in the United States. Nearly 5,000 people have died from AIDS. Although homosexual males and intravenous drug abusers account for most of the cases of AIDS in the United States so far, there is increasing concern about the risk to the heterosexual population. In Africa, where the disease developed, an equal number of males and females have the virus.
Of all AIDS cases to that date in 1985, 51% of adults and 59% of children with the virus had died. 2 years later, in 1987, the U.S. death toll topped 40,000. The death toll spurred activist groups like ACT UP here in New York to action. This is from a WNYC report in that period.
You're under arrest. You're under arrest. Are you going to go peacefully?
An estimated 3,000 protesters from the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, or ACT UP, accused the Koch administration of negligence and mismanagement in dealing with the AIDS crisis. ACT UP member Ray Passion has been diagnosed as having AIDS. He says he's terrified there won't be a hospital bed available for him when he needs it.
I've been lucky so far. I haven't been in the hospital, but I have friends who've waited for 4 and 5 days. So it's like really scary for me.
A report on ACT UP demonstrators from WNYC's Andy Lancet now our archivist, for All Things Considered in the late 1980s. The ACT UP activists also worked to combat discrimination against the LGBT community members in New York City in the 80s. Here's Tom Duane, who went on to be an elected official, then an ACT UP activist at a meeting on housing rights.
And this is Bernard Braverman, who's in danger of being evicted from his apartment that he shared with his life partner for many, many years. His life partner died, and the landlord wants Bernard out of his home because his name was not on the lease.
What's his landlord's address?
There are cards here to fill out to write to the governor. Let's make sure that our voices are heard in New York City to save the homes of PWAs and other non-traditional families. Thank you.
Tom Duane, who went on to serve in the New York City Council and as the first HIV-positive politician in the New York State Senate. Now, a central part of this series all week, as many of you know, is your oral history calls, focusing on a different decade each show. So our oral history question for today, for any LGBTQ listeners who were around at that time, is how did you express your pride and how did you experience prejudice in the 1980s? Tell us a story that's an important memory for you from the 80s right now at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 if you were a part of ACT UP or anything else. We invite you to call and tell us something you remember from the political activity in that at that time, or maybe some of your personal losses. You can feel free to call and even just remember somebody who died in the 1980s, because it was just unbelievable at that time how many people were losing how many people. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for your oral history calls. And joining me now is Peter Staley, HIV/AIDS activist, former member of ACT UP New York, and founder of the Treatment Action Group. Peter, so nice to have you in our studio.
Great to be here, Brian. Happy Pride.
What's the first thing you were thinking as you were listening to that history tape crawl?
A lot of loss, a lot of ghosts. Even some of the chants you had from the big ACT UP demonstration outside City Hall, where 3,000 were protesting against Mayor Koch, many of them did not survive. So there were chants in that broadcast that of lives snuffed out. So it was a painful time.
And you've talked publicly about how you were diagnosed with HIV in 1985. As I mentioned in that read, the number of cases in 85 itself had increased by 89% from the previous year. Can you take us back to that day? What was it like to learn about your diagnosis back then based on what medical knowledge and likely prognosis was in 1985?
Well, 85 was a year that the country finally started taking notice, mostly because of the news about Rock Hudson, which happened, I think, in August. And then he died, I believe, around September of that year. The HIV test had only come out that summer. They had only discovered the virus the year before. The country went into a national panic, kind of like it did with Ebola a couple years ago. There were magazine covers, and parents were pulling their kids out of schools if there were rumors about a child having HIV. And in the midst of all that, I got diagnosed with AIDS-related complex about a week before Thanksgiving in November. There were no treatments. It was considered a kind of a death sentence diagnosis. And I went home and came out and tried to start creating a support group that would buy me some time.
And here you are 34 years later.
Mostly, and I'm convinced, just because of dumb luck. Only about 20% of the gay men in my cohort who were becoming infected in the 80s made it to 1996.
I was surprised to hear that history clip from then Health and Human Services Secretary Margaret Heckler Reagan appointee as early as 1983, at least that's how it was identified, trying to dispel some of the myths and irrational fears about how people could or could not contract HIV. There was a lot of protest at that time against the Reagan administration for not taking it seriously, right?
Right. I mean, heckler was about as high as it went for anybody in the Reagan administration to even speak about the new epidemic. Reagan hadn't said the word, didn't say the word until a press release in late 85, didn't give a speech on it until 87, 6 years into the crisis. Imagine if that's how we handled Ebola or swine flu or Legionnaires, where there was immediate front page coverage in all the newspapers, national news stories for weeks, immediate action by our federal government, because it's a new epidemic and you have to nip it in the bud early. This was one that everybody just decided to ignore because it was hitting fags and IV drug users, and they didn't care.
So many marginalized communities.
Exactly.
It was wrongly believed that Haitians were at, independent risk. And that was another marginalized community to begin with. And eventually the medical community corrected that error.
Right.
But yet another community that it was easy to ignore.
Yeah, they called it the three H's back then. Homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and Haitian immigrants.
Right, hemophiliacs, because it was transmitted by blood transfusions, right, in some cases, and after blood donations by people who didn't realize that they were HIV positive.
And the one of the great, the AIDS crisis is known for dark humor. One of the great AIDS jokes is, as hard as it was to go home to my parents and tell them I had AIDS, it was much harder to convince them that I was a Haitian immigrant.
I get it. Dark humor indeed. The protest in the city that we played the clip from, you said it was on the steps of City Hall or at City Hall. If Ronald Reagan was the target of HIV protests, how much was Ed Koch, as mayor at that time, the target? Ed Koch, who was widely believed to be gay male himself.
Right. Widely known to be a classic closet case, and we were convinced that was restricting his response. There was no emergency city posture, even though this was ground zero. Larry Kramer and GMHC infamously tried to get meetings and push them and got a stone wall most of the time,
so to speak.
So by 88, ACT UP staged its largest demonstration to date outside City Hall, hoping to tip the balance of the upcoming election against him. And sure enough, I think it was 80% of the LGBT vote went against him, and he lost, and we got him kicked out of office.
We have a full board of oral history callers.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take one. Maxine in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maxine.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I want to do a couple of things. One is to remember the women who fought for AIDS care, people like Katrina Haslip and Iris Dela Cruz and Phyllis Sharp and Lydia Awadawa, who worked with ACT UP Women's Committee, of which I was one of the members, and we also had a National Women's Committee. People never talk about us, talk about being erased. We worked for 4 years on a campaign to change the Centers for Disease Control definition of AIDS, which was based on those very early cases of gay men, even though women were getting very different kinds of illnesses. And because they didn't get an AIDS definition, no matter how badly they were doing, they couldn't get disability, nobody was researching their infections, nobody was testing drugs to see if it worked for them. And we did 4 years of two big demonstrations at the Centers for Disease Control, one in the pouring rain that had 100 infected women who were there despite the pouring rain. We did postcard campaigns across the world. We did a huge ad in the New York Times. And finally, in 1992, James Curran, who was then the head of the CDC, had to admit that what we were talking about was true after 4 years of denying it all. So those women were amazing, as were all the women across the country who worked on that campaign. And many people never talk about it, but it saved many, many lives, not just here, but in the other countries, because other countries used the Centers for Disease Control's definition of AIDS was used by the World Health Organization. And so women in other countries were in the same situation.
Maxine, thank you so much for that memory and that acknowledgement. And Peter Staley, in 1987, following up on Maxine's call, the first HIV drug, AZT, came to market. Burroughs Wellcome, the manufacturer, set the price around $10,000 a year. Can you talk about what the first drug meant to the community and how the price impacted folks with HIV?
Sure. Well, let me go back first. That was Maxine Wolfe, who, I mean, if there was the...
You know each other.
Very well. She's amazing. If the father of ACT UP is Larry Kramer, the mother of ACT UP is Maxine Wolfe. And she is completely right that it was a unique coming together of gay men and lesbians, this movement. Lesbians who had far more experience in other movements, fight for the ERA and pro-choice and the war movement, and they brought their experience to ACT UP and transplanted it in. They were a crucial voice. Gay men and lesbians hadn't been doing a whole lot together in the late 70s and the early 80s. They were kind of in their separate planets. And here they came together, and it was that joining that really made a difference.
And am I right that because of the high price, you led an action at the Burroughs Wellcome corporate headquarters in April of 1989, and in September of that year, you went to the New York Stock Exchange before the opening bell to protest the pricing?
Yeah, we got into the stock exchange. We got onto the floor, the only time that's ever been accomplished, and drowned out the opening bell with marine foghorns. And 3 days later, the company lowered the price by 20%. So we had a great effect. At the time, it seems like a quaint drug price now. It seems cheap, but it was the largest, it was the highest drug price in history, $10,000 a year when the company came out with it. And we all thought it might buy us many years. It turned out to only buy us some months or possibly a year before HIV would become resistant to it. Wasn't AZT's fault. It's just we hadn't figured out combination therapy yet.
In our series, Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall, with ACT UP, Stalwart, Peter Staley, and your oral history calls, Richard in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Yes, Brian. First of all, it's a beautiful show, but I have a unique history. I'm a retired funeral director, and you could see the good and the bad in people when the AIDS epidemic came about. Many, many funeral homes, not only the funeral home, hospitals, discriminated against the AIDS virus. Many, when we picked the cases up, instead of going to the morgue, most of them left the remains and the beloved deceased in the bed. They wouldn't take them to the regular morgue, and we go straight up to the room to pick the case up because they were afraid. And when the cases would come to us, by the way, there was only a few, and I did trade work. Now, trade work is when you do work for the embalmer. I wasn't really an embalmer. Mm-hmm. For many funeral homes, just for one. And the greatest calls we got, and I hate to say it, but I was discriminatory too, because the market would be like, instead of getting, say, a set amount, say $100, which is way above that, we started getting four and five times. I was able to accumulate a lot of savings during that time. And not only did
In other words, you got a premium for dealing with the bodies
absolutely.
Of people who died absolutely. From AIDS?
Absolutely. I would get calls from Brooklyn. I was located up in the Bronx area. And I would get calls from Brooklyn and even from New Jersey.
Because a lot of your peers just wouldn't do it.
Yeah, but they're not the only ones that they were afraid. And a lot of the this was past the public was afraid too, because many mm-hmm. people that were such devout Christians or Jewish, whatever they were, they would not even kiss the deceased, and some people wanted to keep the casket closed because they didn't want any probability of discharge of disease. And if they had known, because the only thing it takes, first of all, AIDS is a weak virus. I was taught this. I found out this out. And all you need is some bleach. And you after a few hours, you're just about like any other disease. But people didn't know this. And so they passed on discrimination in the public. Some people were even as, I shouldn't say ignorant. Yes, they were ignorant and said they didn't know. They wouldn't even come to the funeral home for the normal viewing.
Do you think that fear mixed with some kind of hate in those cases, or was it just fear of disease?
I think many was fear.
Yeah.
I guess there were many people who expressed hate because people come to see people that I hate, that I hated all the time. They come to the wake or wherever it may be. And I hate to say this, but there were even churches that would not allow, and if they knew, they found out that the deceased, which they inevitably would, because when I said, well, you know, he had AIDS or this or that, they wouldn't even allow them in some churches. And I've been in all types of churches. I've been in synagogues where this has happened. So it was a mm-hmm. horrific time for people to show their discrimination and to show that they, but they would, most of it came from ignorance and fear.
Richard, thank you so much.
It was a good and bad time because I took advantage of it because I said, look, I even got a huge amount of money. Well, people didn't want the case to come even come into the funeral home, so they would have me pick the case up, have the casket and so forth delivered to where I was working,
and Richard,
and deliver the casket to the particular establishment.
Thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it, Richard. What an unusual and moving piece of oral history from an embalmer and funeral director from that time.
First-hand account of what we witnessed again and again, especially in the first half of the 80s, where the fear was just overwhelming, even in New York City. There was like one funeral home that was the only one taking people with HIV in the West Village, and everybody just ended up using them, and lots of hospital problems early on, nurses being unwilling to go into the patient's room and meals being left at the door. And it took many years to resolve that original fear and that original stigma.
More Peter Staley, more of your oral history calls, more Prejudice and Pride decade by decade since Stonewall, Part 3, the 80s, after this. Queen in 1984, as we continue with our Stonewall Anniversary Week series, Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall. We're in the 80s today with Peter Staley, HIV AIDS activist, former member of ACT UP New York and founder of the Treatment Action Group, and your oral history calls. Peter, I want you to reflect on how ACT UP kind of set the template, I think, for protest groups I'm thinking of two different things at the same time, which is why I'm stumbling, both for other diseases mm-hmm. and how there may have been an irony, you tell me, of the 1980s seeing this devastation of especially the gay male community and the fear and loathing that would come along with that, and at the same time launch the community to the next phase of civil rights.
Right. On the first front, how we affected other disease groups, prior to ACT UP, patients were generally kept out of the research process, the healthcare leadership in the healthcare community, decisions that affected our lives. And it was really the birth of patient advocacy where we convinced the medical establishment that we could become self-educated experts in our own diseases and bring insight to the meetings that would make decisions on research and drug approvals and be equal partners in that process. And now all disease groups are represented at the table with pharmaceutical companies and the NIH and the FDA as as research progresses. And at the same time, it was the first time America saw thousands of homosexuals taking to the streets month after month in an angry, organized, passionate way, fighting back, taking charge, coming out to our parents. I mean, AIDS kind of forced us out of the closet. And we realized that by going national, challenging everyone from the president on down, that we could change the system. We found our power, we found our voice, and there was no going back after that. That really reinvigorated the movement, the queer movement, and we've been indignant ever since. We've never lost that sense of indignation, that how could you let us die? Now it's like, how can you keep us out of this, out of how can you keep trans people out of the military? I mean, it's just indignation.
How were you at the 1989 ACT UP protest at St. Patrick's Cathedral?
I was. I got arrested laying down in the aisles there.
People who don't know that story would be fascinated to hear that story. What happened at St. Patrick's Cathedral?
Well, we were protesting the Catholic Church in general because the posture from the Pope on down was that condoms were a sin and should not be used, which obviously increased the spread of HIV. And we considered their position to be sinful and deadly. Because it was the Catholic Church and it's a church and it's the Pope, there was this reticence about, you know, full frontal challenge. This was many years before their scandals over that they've been living with ever since. But we walked in there and
you all kind of walked in individually as if you were just attending a service.
There was a huge demonstration. They knew we were coming. 3,000 people outside. It was in a coalition with a pro-choice group called WHAM, and over 100 of us walked in suits and ties, pretended to be parishioners. And when the homily started, we started a quiet, what was supposed to be a silent die-in in the aisles. And Pose, the FX series, just recreated this on their first episode of the second season, and quite beautifully, I thought.
Saul in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Saul. Thank you so much for calling.
I'd like to share a brief oral history from an event that occurred in June of 1985, which is widely unknown, but nevertheless was a major milestone in the global history of the AIDS epidemic. In that month, I was a 22-year-old new master's graduate in Chinese language and Chinese literature, and I'd gotten my very first job, which was leading American tour groups to the People's Republic of China. I had lived in China as an undergraduate, and I was one of the few Americans then that spoke fluent Mandarin and had spent time in China. The tour I led that month was a 28-day tour around the world trip, starting with 10 days in China and then going by Trans-Siberian Railroad to Moscow and Leningrad. And on the third day of the tour in the city of Nanjing in China, a 34-year-old American, a man traveling alone on the tour, came up to me at the breakfast in the hotel and said he wasn't feeling well and he would sit out the sightseeing for the day, which on tour groups was not, anything to worry about because people often catch colds or get bronchitis or whatever. The next day he came to me to say the same thing. He was feeling worse and he confessed to me that he had leukemia. And that he thought he was starting to react from some chemotherapy he had right before he left the States. So I offered to take him to be seen by doctors or a hospital, but he said he didn't want to do that. He wanted to stay on the tour for the China portion, which would include three other cities, and then return to Los Angeles from Beijing before the departure on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. The next 4 days through the rest of China, he started to get worse and worse from city to city. And I had already arranged for his return to Los Angeles, but he was walking with difficulty. He was breathing heavily. Finally, when we got to Beijing, we learned that the airline would not let him board the flight because of his health condition. And only then did he agree to let me have him hospitalized. Back then, there was only one hospital, the best hospital in Beijing, the Peking Union Medical College, that was authorized to treat foreigners. So I took him there.
And I think I know where this is headed, but just for time.
Oh, I'll cut to the chase for time. So I had him hospitalized, and it seemed like he would be well cared for, and then I left, and then he died that very night in the hospital. When he died, the doctors couldn't understand why under their care he had died. They called his physician in Los Angeles, who said, oh no, he doesn't have leukemia, he has AIDS. Now, his death precipitated a earthquake in China. It was the first time in history that the Chinese health ministry paid attention to the disease. They immediately implemented blood screening. They immediately implemented tests for foreigners coming to China. They set up a task force with the best physicians in the country to pay attention to the disease. And it was really, you know, his name was Oscar Messina, and I only mention that because I memorialized his death in a 2010 Huffington Post blog called Remembering Oscar.
Good to mention people's names out loud.
But his death, which was lonely in Beijing without his family and friends, moved the largest country in the world to sit up for the very first time and take notice of the AIDS crisis.
Great.
And then gradually understand that it wasn't just a foreign disease, it would also be a domestic one.
Thank you so much for that. What a story. Lou in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lou.
Yes, hi. I'll try to be a little shorter. I wanted to make sure that we knew that the recovering community, at least the part of the recovering community that used to share needles, has a lot to be proud for when it comes to pride. We have so many things in common, but we have to be grateful to act up. And maybe Peter can talk about this. In the 80s, the first time I ever exchanged a needle was because ACT UP had a needle exchange in the Lower East Side. And I attribute that, not having to share needles, to having saved my life. I know a lot of people that didn't have the same opportunity and had to share needles and are no longer with us. And one second thing that maybe Peter can talk about that hasn't also been said, at least in the 2 weeks that I've been hearing, is that a lot of the drug users were also MSN, which is a term that we no longer use. Maybe Peter can talk about that. But there were a lot of male drug users that had sex with other men, and that also needs to be addressed. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for your call. And Peter, that must feel good hearing somebody saying the ACT UP needle exchange saved his life.
Yeah, and great activists like Richard Elovich set it up, and it was one of the first needle exchange programs in the world. And it was illegal, and they had run-ins with cops. But eventually, other cities started writing exceptions to the laws to do pilot programs. And in most major cities in the U.S., we do have needle exchange programs. They still run into issues with the law. We saw an outbreak in Indiana under Vice President Pence because they did not distribute clean needles in his state. And so while the IV drug use spread of HIV has plummeted because of these programs, there are still pockets around the country in red areas where it can flare up.
One more. Sandra in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling, Sandra.
Hi. I was the vice president of the Gay and Lesbian Student Union for my college in the early 80s, and we came to New York and we marched with a sign that said, "Gay still means happy." Even though it was a sad time, and I tell you, all of those officers, I'm sorry, I don't want to lose it, all of those officers I worked with are now just dead because of AIDS. I'd send out a Christmas card and get back an obituary. But at that time, there were more clubs than ever. The community was huge, strong, and loving. And you don't have the clubs in the community that we had. That's why ACT UP should be applauded. There was a network of people. I think that the dementia community needs to take a example from ACT UP. Chain yourself to the chairs of congressmen so we can get things done. They were amazing, and they did work that I see nowhere else in the world. But there was still a strong, loving, vibrant gay and lesbian community. Look at Christopher Street and all the bars up and down. There were three or four lesbian bars. I think there's one now. It was a different time. It was unhappy, but there was also a wonderful, vibrant, loving community. So I don't want people to just think that the 80s was a 100% tragedy and there was no love and happiness.
It's a great way to end. Sandra and Peter, do you want to expand on that?
Well, I'd just double down. I mean, Sandra is so right. It was a very tragic period, but it was also one of the most beautiful community responses I've ever witnessed. I wish I could bottle it and hand it out today. It was filled with love and a sense of family and fighting back. And we changed the world. And we still are fighting today. I'm involved with a group called Prep for All, which is making waves in Congress and against the CDC and against the pharmaceutical industry, specifically Gilead, because they charge $20,000 a year for a drug that can prevent HIV infections. So the work goes on.
Peter Staley's work goes on. He has been an HIV/AIDS activist, former member of ACT UP New York, founder of the Treatment Action Group, and now with Prep for All, as he just said. Thank you so much for joining our series, Prejudice and Pride, Decade by Decade Since Stonewall.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, the series continues at the same time with the 90s.
Down.